Even as the president pushes for tax reform in Congress, he's been embroiled in continuing controversy over how he handled a phone call to the widow of a soldier killed in Niger. Maisha Johnson, wife of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, was on ABC's Good Morning America today. Here's how she describes the phone call with the president.
Said that he knew what he signed up for, but it hurts anyways. It made me cry because I was very angry at the tone of his voice and how he said it. Like he couldn't remember my husband's name. The only way he remembered my husband's name because he told me he had my husband report in front of him.
Now, President Trump defended his actions this morning. He defended his actions as respectful, tweeting this morning that he, quote, spoke his name from the beginning without hesitation. Well, joining us for an update on Washington politics is NPR White House reporter Jeff Bennett. Hi there, Jeff.
Hey, Meghna.
So this is the first time that Sergeant Johnson's widow has spoken publicly about this phone call. I mean, is the president continuing to fuel this controversy? Or, I mean, just tell us about where we are today.
Well, we know the president cannot let go unanswered any slight, no matter from whom it comes. This isn't the first time the president has been embroiled with a debate with the Gold Star family. But here you have Maisha Johnson giving her first public comments after laying her husband to rest on Saturday. And the president is effectively calling her, this Gold Star widow, a liar, even though folks at the White House are not backing up the president's claim. Now, the president earlier said that Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who is a friend of the Johnson family, who was riding in the limousine and heard on speakerphone of the president's comments, she said that President Trump told the widow that he knew what he was signing up for and that the president didn't seem to recall Sergeant Johnson's name. Now, we know from the White House Chief of Staff, General Kelly, that that is actually true. What Wilson said that the president told Maisha Johnson is the case. And now you hear from Maisha Johnson herself how it came to be that the president, she said, stumbled as he was trying to relay whatever comments he was trying to make to her. And so, you know, you have folks at the White House who would much rather turn the page, particularly this week, at the beginning of this week, to tax reform, to health care. It's something that Republican members on the Hill in particular would really just like to let go and move on from.
Huh. Well, you know, with all this focus on this on the phone call and the tone the president took and what he did or didn't say, it seems as if the controversy, though, is taking attention away from the basic question of what Sergeant LaJohnson and his fellow soldiers were even doing in Niger. Isn't that the case?
That is the case. And I think that story changed, particularly last week, when Senator John McCain, who's chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, threatened to subpoena the Trump administration to get more information about the circumstances surrounding this ambush. And then, you know, the very next day, he met with the defense secretary, Jim Mattis. But, you know, you make the point. Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, his body was found nearly a mile away from the central scene of that ambush in Niger. And the Pentagon is looking at the exact circumstances of how he became separated from his unit when they were ambushed by these 50 ISIS fighters. This is what we understand from the sort of early account of what happened. And the FBI is also investigating this, too. So even as the president refutes what LaDavid Johnson's widow says, the investigation into the circumstances surrounding his death is still ongoing.
Well, so let's hear a little bit from Senator Lindsey Graham about this. He spoke to NBC's Meet the Press, again, to the point you were making, Jeff, about how the Senate is going to try to clarify the situation here.
Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly where we're at in the world militarily and what we're doing. So John McCain is going to try to create a new system mm-hmm. to make sure that we can answer the question, why were we there? We'll know how many soldiers are there, and if somebody gets killed there, that we won't find out about it in the paper.
So in the last couple of seconds that we have, Jeff, you mentioned mm-hmm. the subpoenas, but any hearings coming up, perhaps?
No hearings that we know of, but we know from that meeting that the military is going to shift its counterterrorism strategy to focus more on Africa. And they're also going to put more decision-making authority in the hands of commanders in the field and potentially expand the ability to use lethal force against suspected terrorists in the field. That's one of the things that Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told Lindsey Graham and John McCain at their meeting last week.
NPR White House reporter Jeff Bennett. Jeff, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now to a political controversy flaring up in a Cub Scout den in Broomfield, Colorado. The Cubs were asked to research current events and prepare questions to ask their Republican state senator, Vicky Marble. Now, the senator is against restricting sales of guns to people with domestic abuse charges. So that's what 11-year-old Ames Mayfield asked about.
Why on earth would you want somebody who beats their wife to have access to a gun? There's something wrong in our country where Republicans believe it's a right to own a gun, but a privilege to have health care.
Well, days later, Ames' mother was told he was kicked out of his den. There are several dens in every pack. Lori Mayfield, Ames' mom, says the pack leader called her. She joins us on her cell from Broomfield, Colorado. Lori, what did he say?
He said, while our politics align, it was something to the effect of, we've got a situation here. The den leader is very upset. Ames is no longer welcome in his den. This doesn't leave us many options. The other den at Ames's rake meets at a time when Ames is in school. And so he said he's sort of a man without a den here, which might be awkward to stay in the pack. And it seemed his interest was in getting us to quickly move along and find another pack.
Did they say why?
So they did. I said, why was his question on gun control that different than questions other scouts asked? And the den leader's son's own question on why people voted for Obama just because he was black and we'd never had a president of color. So he just said gun control was just too politically charged of a question.
So Ames, as you said, is a man without a den. How's he doing?
You know, it's been one heck of a week. Initially, he was crestfallen. You know, he said, but I liked the name of his den leader. And I tried to assure him that we're Mayfield strong, we'll get through this. We have found another pack, and Ames will go to that first den meeting this Wednesday night.
Okay, well, best to him and you.
Thank you so much.
All right, well, Senator Marble told the Denver Post she thought Ames was manipulated. Lori, his mom, says Ames wrote the questions. Marshall Zellinger is with 9 News in Colorado. He joins us by Skype. And Marshall, you've seen the research. Ames did have quite a buildup to that question.
It was really like a 2-minute, 20-second question. And if you watch the video, he's got at least 2 pages that he flips through as he's reading this question. He prepared this like he was doing a research paper.
He's a kid who's very interested in current events.
He's the treasurer of his student government in 5th grade. So this is very detailed oriented questions from someone who really is immersed in this.
But we understand other scouts in this same session asked questions like, why did people vote for President Obama? I'm paraphrasing here, but did they vote for him just because he was black?
She has video of other scouts asking questions. And the most basic question I heard was, what do you think of President Trump's thoughts on the border wall? Another one about fracking, which is actually a big issue in her district here. So the questions about gun control from her son were not the only ones that were pointed. And no one's really had a discussion about like the one that you brought up. Where did that one come from?
Ames also asked about comments the senators made in the past about blacks and genetics. Tell us about that exchange.
4 years ago, there was a discussion where the senator had brought up something about life expectancy of African Americans and started going down a path of talking about diets and
genetics,
fried chicken and that got in there somewhere. And so he had done his research and saw this on a Google search and asked her about saying those things, to which the one crystal clear part of the video from the video that the mom shot is the senator saying something to the effect of, I didn't say that. That was made up by the media. Well, there's audio out there of that. Regardless of what you think of the questions, the answers that are being given by the lawmaker at this point could be a story of its own.
Well, in fact, we have that sound. Here is Senator Marble in 2013 talking about the life expectancy of blacks.
Diabetes is something that's prevalent in the genetic makeup, and you just can't help it. Although I gotta say, I've never had better barbecue and better chicken and ate better in my life than when you go down south.
So 11-year-old Ames asked her about that, asked her about issuing guns to people who've been charged with domestic violence, and he's kicked out of his den. He's gotten a lot of support. Gabby Gifford, the former Arizona rep, of course, who was shot, called him courageous, tweeted him. said call her in 14 years so that she could campaign for him. Her husband, Mark Kelly, called Ames, and you asked him how he felt about being kicked out of his den.
I am really heartbroken that my den leader, which I really felt like I had a pretty good relationship with, decided to kick me out.
Marshall Zellinger, what's been other reaction, though, in the area?
Mixed, as you would expect on something political like this. But for the most part, at least on social media, everyone seems to be leaning toward the support of the Cub Scout. And, you know, what are you getting kicked out for? Then it starts going down the path of, well, what about the answers she gave? And I don't know how you can fault an 11-year-old for just basically being thorough in a project.
That's Marshall Zellinger, investigative reporter with 9 News in Denver, on the new tempest in the Cub Scout den there. Marshall, thank you.
Thank you.
A brand new cookbook sheds light on a cuisine you might not be familiar with unless you're eating it or heard about it in our conversation with Chef Sean Sherman, the Sioux chef, as in S-I-O-U-X. He grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota and is now preserving traditional Native American cuisine and bringing it to the world through his catering company, Tatanka Truck, his food truck, and now his cookbook, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Sean Sherman is a member of the Oglala Lakota Sioux. We caught up with him last November to find out more. How did this start for you? Talk about growing up on the Pine Ridge Reservation, one of the largest and one of the most impoverished, not really eating the food of your forefathers.
Right. You know, lots of wide open spaces, lots of plains. We kind of bordered the Badlands in South Dakota. And, you know, we grew up kind of running around, playing outdoors a lot. And we didn't really have restaurants. We had one grocery store in the town of Pine Ridge itself. So we'd spent a lot of time hunting and kind of running around, being free. We were probably a little feral.
Well, thankfully, foraging for berries and things like that. And I say thankfully because there was such poverty, so little industry, that there was a lot of government food.
Yep, lots of the government cheese and canned salmon and canned beef and, you know, canned generic everything, basically.
Spam.
Right,
Spam.
Right. You know, later in life when I kind of had the epiphany of focusing on my own culture and heritage as a chef, I really did have to dig backwards and try to figure out what that meant because there was a lot of missing information as to what really was Native American food. And we had bits and pieces of it growing up, but I knew there was a lot more to it. So we did have the choke cherries and we did have things like the wild timsala, which is a prairie turnip. And, you know, there's lots of wild onion and, you know, there was a lot of flavors out there in the wild game. But I just knew that there was so much more to it.
Well, in fact, too, I understand there are certain foods you will not eat now because it was part of the government food that you had.
Well, you know, for the work that we're doing and focusing on pre-reservation, pre-European foods for North America, we've cut out ingredients that weren't here before. So we've cut out wheat flour and dairy and processed sugar, even beef, pork and chicken.
And so, what are you cooking?
Well, you know, proteins are easy because we have all of this wild game. So we use a lot of venison and rabbit and bison, turkey and quail, lots of the freshwater fish around us, so lots of walleye and trout, northerns, whitefish, things like that. And then the bigger piece for us was really getting an education on the plant life, so the ethnobotany and the agricultural scene that was happening. So looking at all the heirloom indigenous seed varieties that people were growing and also plants that people were collecting and using all of those flavors on the plates that we're creating.
And when you say people, you've been called the second generation of Native American trying to find these foods.
Yeah, there's been a lot of great work out there. I've learned a lot from some of the ethnobotanists out there, a lot from the elders who still know and practice a lot of these pieces in the different reservations.
So this all culminates in things like the Indian taco.
Well, for our food truck here in Minneapolis called Tatanka Truck, we did a take on Indian tacos, which was typically fry bread with kind of Tex-Mex flavored meat and beans and lettuce and sour cream called an indigenous taco.
It's what the more modern Native American came up with using things like wheat flour that they wouldn't have used 150 years ago.
Right. You know, fry bread, it doesn't take too long to figure out where that starts from. Really, it's just, you know, what the government was giving Native American people to survive off after they started moving around to reservations. So staples like flour and lard and sugar and salt, there's not a lot you can do with that, especially if you don't have any ovens, but make a simple fried dough. And hence, that's where fry bread comes from.
So a nod to the more modern indigenous taco, but you also do a more indigenous taco.
We just wanted to do something that was more health-based, so we did a corn base instead of a fry bread, where we basically just grill a corn cake, almost like a grilled polenta, and then we top it with whatever. We have rabbit, we have bison, we have turkey, we have beans and squash. Since we're not using any dairy in anything, everything's pretty much plant-based if it doesn't have the meat particularly on it. And we use a lot of wild flavor, so we gather a lot of wild herbs during the summertime. And we top it off with wojapi, which is just the berry sauce.
Wojapi, what is that?
So growing up on Pine Ridge, we had a sauce called wojapi, which was traditionally chokecherry. So we would collect the chokecherries in the late summer. And then I can remember my grandmother making, you know, huge pots of it on the stove. And that was pretty typical for a lot of Lakota families. But wojapi really, in the simplest form, is just a berry sauce. So you can use pretty much any berry you want to.
And you cook it down.
Yeah, we just cook it down, and you know, we don't bother thickening it. I've seen a lot of modern recipes where they add sugar or cornstarch, but we just kind of let it go down until it gets thickened on its own.
Put it on tacos, put it on ice cream.
It's good on everything.
Yeah. What's it like to bite into something and know that that's actually, you know, your food? Maybe I'm reaching here, but can you feel something when you bite into something that you know your ancestors might have eaten?
Yeah, and we see it all the time because we go to a lot of these tribal communities and we'll do these foods that are just very simple, the indigenous foods of that region. And it's fun to watch people's faces and see all of these memories get pulled out and this kind of ancestral memory coming out of the food and just, you know, really affecting people in such a positive way. And you can feel it. It's just, you know, good, clean, and great energy food.
Well, and there's another purpose here. We talk about the history of the reservations when you say they were given the government-issued food when they had to move. Well, these were forced marches. And it just seems as if many of the Native peoples have not recovered. There's a huge incidence of, well, alcoholism, diabetes, heart disease. Is part of this about eating better?
Yes, because the indigenous diet just happens to be such a healthy diet. You know, it's low glycemic, it's high in vegetation, it's low salt, it's good fats, lots of seeds and nuts, lots of really healthy proteins. So it's great that the indigenous diet itself was so healthy because, you know, before European influence, there was very little things like the type 2 diabetes and obesity and heart disease and hypertension and even tooth decay. So by bringing back a lot of these traditional flavors and getting people with the mindset of wanting to have these traditional foods more often on their tables, we can really directly take on a lot of those foodborne illnesses just through traditional food.
Do you see Americans finally turning back to their real Native American food?
Well, I think that the food that we're doing and really getting people to open up and understand and respect the indigenous background of this country, it really helps re-identify what American food is. You know, instead of just being hamburger and Coca-Cola for the United States or poutine for Canada, it's really more regionally specific. You know, if there were Native American restaurants that were culturally and regionally appropriate all over the United States and Canada, people would really see that huge diversity of all these awesome food and flavors and culture that we have. And you don't have to be from indigenous background to appreciate and respect those pieces that are just part of our landscape.
Yeah. Sean Sherman, the Sioux chef. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we spoke with Sean Sherman last November. Again, his cookbook, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Cuisine, is out this month. Staying with food, it's apple and pumpkin season in much of the country, but pawpaws also signal autumn. Pawpaws are the regional delicacy that have been called the best fruit you've never tried. Ali Schweitzer from member station WAMU visited a pawpaw orchard in Maryland to get a taste.
In the Deep Run Pawpaw Orchard in Carroll County, Maryland, Donna Davis shows me how to eat a pawpaw.
You just split it open and then suck out the flesh.
The fruit looks like a large mango, but inside it's soft and custard-like, and it tastes sweet and creamy, like banana pudding. Davis has been picking pawpaws in the orchard all day, and she hasn't been able to resist dipping into the supply.
today, this is probably my third one.
As tasty as pawpaws are, these plump and squishy fruits aren't very well known. You won't find them in most grocery stores. But they're actually native to the southeastern U.S. and Appalachia. American Indians harvested them. And it's been said George Washington liked to eat chilled pawpaw for dessert. Today, Davis and her husband Jim are just one of a handful of growers who specialize in the fruit. So I asked, why grow the pawpaw?
Because they said it couldn't be done. I think that's why my husband started it, because they said it couldn't be done.
Pawpaws are not that easy to cultivate. They need slightly acidic, well-drained soil, and harvesting them is labor-intensive. Much of their natural habitat has been destroyed by development. But the locavore food movement has embraced the fruit, and there are restaurants whipping up pawpaw pie and pawpaw gelato, and breweries are making pawpaw beer. So while the fruit has historically been called the Quaker Delight and the hillbilly mango, it's now earned another nickname, the hipster banana.
I think she wants another one.
At the 5th annual Pawpaw Festival in Rockville, Maryland, it's clear the pawpaw craze is well underway. Karen Holt is standing in line, waiting to pay $50 for 10 large pawpaws.
I got here 2 hours early. I got my pawpaws.
Holt says she's going to make pawpaw pie, but most people seem content to just eat them right out of their skin. Rhonda Barrett describes the taste.
I always think it tastes like a combination of an avocado and a mango mixed together.
Others say pawpaws taste like vanilla, caramel, and coconut. And as more people line up to buy pawpaws, the Flower Hill String Band plays the official pawpaw anthem. It's an old Appalachian folk tune called the Pawpaw Patch. Picking up pawpaws, put them in Just an hour into the festival, the pawpaws are almost sold out. But some attendees are walking away with pawpaw trees. Arthur Rapinski is one of the lucky buyers.
I'm going to plant it in my backyard where we have kind of a shady spot.
Along with professional pawpaw growers, pawpaw hobbyists like Rapinski are making sure the pawpaw is here to stay.
All right, Pawpaw Festival 2017!
For Here and Now, I'm Allie Schweitzer.
And Meghna,
I always get so hungry when I'm here.
Oh, we need a pawpaw. We're making an unabashed plea for pawpaws, if they're mailable.
There will be no change to your 401k. That's what President Donald Trump tweeted this morning in response to reports that House Republicans are considering reducing the amount of pre-tax contributions that people can make to their retirement account. The president tweeted, "This has always been a great and popular middle-class tax break that works, and it stays," end quote. Well, joining us now with more is Jill Schlesinger. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi there, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so this is a big deal in retirement and planning circles here. What exactly were House Republicans considering?
Well, there was a little bit of a floated idea here where maybe there would be a limit as to how much money that goes into a 401k pre-tax, getting that exemption, would be capped at. And there were some thoughts around $2,400. And, you know, that think about this. Right now, you can put up to $18,000 in a 401k or a 457 or a 403b. And going up to 18.5 next year. So imagine that just 2,400 of that would be able to go in pre-tax. That would be a big deal.
Well, you're the $16,000 reduction. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But not a lot of people are maxing out. Okay. So we already know that that maxing out part of it really does favor people who make a lot of money. But the problem is that the folks who don't make as much money, they like getting that tax deduction. They like knowing that I put $1,000 into my 401k, but it really only cost me about $750 because Uncle Sam helps chip in with the $250 because I'm not getting taxed on that money. And there was a real concern among a lot of certified financial planners and retirement experts. This is going to cause some people to actually put less money away from retirement at a time where we don't have enough people contributing to retirement.
Yeah. But Jill, let me ask you, what was the impetus behind this idea to begin with? Was it to pay for tax cuts?
Well, yeah. I mean, the idea is that if you actually limit this deduction or exemption, it would actually be able to raise about $115 billion in this fiscal year. Now, that's something really interesting because, remember, part of the plan that is going on right now is what is the impact over the next 10 years, right? Because beyond 10 years, we're not thinking about too far. And when you put the money in after tax for a retirement contribution, the net effect for the government doesn't occur for decades down the line. That's why Roth IRAs, they actually can be a very good vehicle where you pay your full tax today, you put money into a retirement account. When you pull the money out later, you don't have to pay a tax. So that's good for you, not so good for the government. But in this plan, it's the short term, which is really the focus and how to raise money in the short term.
Okay. And now, of course, we don't know if this idea is going to have any legs because the president tweeted what he did, that he doesn't want any changes. But in the last, 40 seconds that we have here, Jill, I'm just curious, does when the taxes hit for 401ks, does it actually change how much people do put in and when? Because it seems like there's some evidence that it actually doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's hard with retirement, it's hard for us to get anyone to contribute any money at any point, okay?
Right.
And so we know that we need to do a better job. The problem that I see in this plan is, again, just like healthcare, you'd be taking away something that people have, and that's awfully hard to do. There are other ways to raise money in the tax code. I think this one is going to be hitting a brick wall, not just because of people, but also because of the financial services lobby.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money, and the podcast Better Off. Always great to talk with you, Jill. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now.
Is this the end of Sears? Stock in the retailer's parent company nosedived last week after investor Bruce Berkowitz, the largest shareholder, announced he was leaving the board, and after Sears Canada announced earlier this month that it would liquidate all of its remaining stores and assets, putting about 12,000 employees out of work. In the U.S., Sears has slid billions of dollars into debt. In the past year, it's announced some 150 store closures, cut more than 100 corporate jobs at its headquarters in suburban Chicago. Industry analysts say the writing is on the wall. How the mighty fall.
Why do I shop at Sears? Yeah. It's easy for me. I can pick up tennis balls, children's clothing, torque wrenches, and a dish all in the same shop.
Sears, where America shops.
Sears was a storied American company. Derek Thompson wrote a terrific piece in The Atlantic comparing it to Amazon. Sears was loved for its iconic deco buildings as well as for the thunk of the catalog in the mail, a lifeline particularly to rural Americans. At one website, searscatalogsonline.com, you can scroll through the years back to 1897. Look, here's a picture of the new light-running Economy Chief cream separator from 1909, 60 days free trial. Jerry Hancock is a high school teacher outside Atlanta, but he's also a self-described Sears historian. He did his master's thesis at Georgia State University on the company. Jerry, your reaction when you heard Sears Canada going out of business?
Very sad. Sears is an American institution. It's part of Americana, and to see it go this way, I think it's a sign of things to come for the United States.
You know, for a generation that's grown up with Amazon, take us back to remind people, Sears didn't have the internet, it had the railroad, and it had mail to get these products to people. It was Richard Sears who sold watches first, joined by Alva Roebuck, who sold clothing. This is in the 1880s. The catalog was king. What did it mean to people?
Well, for me personally, I grew up in rural Georgia in a small farming community, and it was school clothes, it was Santa Claus, it was all of those things. That catalog is not only access to that merchandise, but it was also, I think, particularly in the South, a window into the future. I think the catalog really taught a lot of Americans about consumption and technology, and now serves as an incredible history book, I think.
It was toy trains, it was rowboats, it was, you know, leotards, guitars, bedroom sets. I'm looking, you know, again on this website. It was stoves. It was everything.
They sold houses. You could build in a kit, 50 gallons of paint, 500 pounds of nails, you know, glass panes, and they would ship it all to a local railroad station, and you would be in charge of getting it from the station to your property, and it went together like Tinker Toys. Yeah. I mean, they really did it all.
Well, then it transitioned, and as Derek Thompson writes in The Atlantic, magnificently, following Americans as they moved into the suburbs. And so suddenly it's had its brick and mortar giant behemoth with these beautiful Art Deco buildings in the suburbs, land cheap, parking plentiful. They hired a World War I general, Robert Wood, who turned to the census to figure out where to go. And he followed Americans with stores.
He really understood it. His background in the military, he was a procurement officer for the Panama Canal Project. And I think that really gave him insight into how to efficiently move large quantities of goods around the country. Basically, what he did was he set up a territory system. He divided the nation into five territories, and supplying those five territories were 10 distribution plants combined with retail stores. So if you go into any of the plants, we have one here in Atlanta that's just been converted into a mixed-use facility called Ponce City Market. And if you go in, you still see remnants of those plants and how they filled the orders with these huge conveyors, these big spiraling chutes. Each floor would get a ticket for whatever items, and they would have the merchandise divided by floor, and they would fill each order. And in the bottom would be a massive mailroom where all of the items would be collected and bundled together. And then literally on the back of the building was a railroad. They would put the items onto the train and ship them out. It was an incredible operation. So they built these 10 plants around the country, fueling these five districts. And each one of the territories had quite a bit of autonomy from the corporate offices in Chicago, and really just served the nation on so many levels.
Hmm. Well, by the way, was your family one of those families that would only buy Sears?
My dad was pretty dedicated, I have to say, to walk into his shop. It's like a timeline of Craftsman tools. He's got vintage toolboxes, and he was pretty dedicated. And yeah, like I say, Santa Claus was a big Sears man too. So
yeah, when those packages would come. But Sears had what Amazon has discovered will happen. You know, there were a lot of people angry because they displaced merchants, particularly in rural areas. That's happened to Amazon as well. And Sears also ran into a lot of trouble in the middle of the last century when they kind of resisted progressive social movements. They were accused of racist tactics in hiring and in sales. African-Americans boycotted in the 1930s and the 1960s. So there were some bumps along the way, and the Smithsonian documents those.
But absolutely.
Yeah. But ultimately, what happened?
Well, from talking to numerous retirees, I've established a relationship in Atlanta with the Atlanta Sears family, which is the largest Sears retirees organization in the country right now. And I tell you, the one theme that always seems to come out in these conversations is that it was the too big to fail mentality. It almost seems like when they built the Sears Tower, they had built this monument to themselves in Chicago. And from that point on, they continually lost touch with that blue-collar working class roots that they had established during the mail order and in early retail. And I actually spoke with one retiree, and he was actually on the corporate level for the Southeast region. He was at a meeting in Chicago and brought up Walmart. And one of the executives on the board in Chicago kicks him under the table, and he says, "I don't want to hear anything about this Walmart. They're a discount store, and they are not competition for this company." Mm. But of course, 1993 was the year that they published the very last Sears catalog. And from that point forward, I think Walmart just really went for the jugular.
Well, and this might be a cautionary tale for Amazon, which bought Whole Foods, which is seen as a high-end store.
It is interesting how they followed that similar model. I do think as long as they don't get too full of themselves like Sears did, that they could probably stay ahead of the curve. It's just incredible to see the similarities between those.
Well, and you wonder why Sears, which it was Amazon before Amazon, really, with the catalog.
Yep.
Mail order was the internet of the day. Wyatt wasn't able to segue back to internet and online orders, so well positioned to do that, and capture what Amazon captured.
It does seem odd that they wouldn't have made that move, but I believe at the corporate level that they were really set on retail and saw the catalogs and the mail order thing as sort of passe by that point. I believe that Sears sort of fell behind in the technology aspect of it, and that's where, like I say, it's just a sad story to see the way that it's going and the direction that it's going. But, you know, Amazon, obviously very tech savvy, and as they move into brick and mortar, are they going to be able to keep their head and be able to fluctuate with market changes? That was one of the things that early Sears was really good at, you know, particularly under General Wood. It's just very interesting to see how history is repeating itself with Amazon right now.
Yeah. That's Jerry Hancock, a high school teacher in Atlanta, but for our purposes today, a Sears historian. Jerry, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
At the White House today, a Vietnam veteran is getting a long overdue special recognition. The U.S. Army Special Forces medic, former Special Forces medic, receives the Medal of Honor from President Trump. He's being honored for bravery during a battle that took place nearly 50 years ago. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock has the story.
My job was to focus on the individuals that were hurt.
In September 1970, Sergeant Gary Michael Rose, known as Mike, was part of a team of 16 Special Forces commandos dropped into the jungles of Laos. Their mission was called Operation Tailwind and included dozens of local tribesmen. They were quickly attacked by hundreds of North Vietnamese troops, and that was the start of a four-day battle that saw Mike Rose in constant motion. He's credited with treating more than 60 wounded men, saving many lives. In fact, all of the American soldiers were wounded during the battle, but because of Rose, none of them died.
When you focus in those kind of circumstances, you don't concern yourself about getting hurt or killed, because if you dwell on that or think about that, you're not going to be able to focus on what you're supposed to be doing, and you probably will get hurt or killed.
Rose was badly wounded himself. A rocket-propelled grenade blew him off his feet. Shards of metal gouged his hand and foot. He said the hole in his foot was big enough to slide his finger through, but he told himself, "I'll worry about that later."
It's really hard to say what Mike did, because he did everything.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Eugene McCarley was Rose's commanding officer during the four-day battle.
Mike never stopped. I know he never slept. I don't know that he ever took time to eat, because he had, from day one, he had his hands full.
Lieutenant Colonel McCarley and others have been lobbying for the Medal of Honor recognition for Mike Rose for decades.
I can't think of anyone any more deserving than Mike to receive this award, and it's an effort that we pushed and we fought for many, many years, and finally it looks like it's coming to pass.
McCarley and Rose were part of the Studies and Observations Group, an elite division of U.S. Special Forces that carried out secret missions throughout the Vietnam War. They were designed to disrupt North Vietnamese forces who were funneling weapons and equipment along a major supply route in Laos. Neil Thorne is an Army veteran who researches and helps to draft medal recommendations.
It was done to take pressure off of Central Intelligence Agency operations further into Laos with some of the local operations that they had going on there.
But officially, the U.S. didn't have troops fighting in Laos. Here's President Richard Nixon speaking in 1969.
There are no American combat forces in Laos. We have been providing logistical support and some training for the neutralist government in order to avoid Laos falling under communist domination.
Operation Tailwind stayed a secret for decades until 1998, when CNN and Time magazine reported that the real goal of the mission was to track down American military defectors. The report also alleged U.S. pilots dropped deadly sarin gas, killing villagers on the ground as they were trying to pull the Americans out of the battle. Rose participated in the Defense Department investigation into those explosive charges.
I did come to
Washington, D.C. As an invitation to the Department of the Army, part of the investigation. But as far as that controversy goes, that was on somebody else. That thing did not happen. It's 20 years ago. I've moved on. It's a non-issue.
The Pentagon found the claims in the report were false, and CNN issued an on-air retraction. Mike Rose is 70 years old now. He and his wife, Margaret, live in Huntsville, Alabama, where he stays active as a volunteer in the community. And in a way, he's living by the same credo now he displayed in Laos in 1970. He said it's as simple as this. He did the right thing.
It's your training. It's your sense of duty. It's your you know these people. It's like, what are you going to do if somebody you know that you have an affection for gets hurt? What are you going to do? Not go to their aid?
By the end of the battle on September 14, 1970, Rose was down to bandanas and shirt sleeves for bandages. One of the final men he treated was a Marine gunner in the helicopter evacuating Rose and other men away from the battle. The Marine's throat had been pierced by a bullet.
If you had seen him on that day, you would have not thought that he would have made it. The whole front of his neck was just, he was a bloody mess, and he was in bad shape, really bad shape. And the fact that he lived all the way to 2012, that just gives me a great sense of accomplishment that I give credit to the people that trained me, that I was able to do something to, in spite of his injuries, to keep him so he could go home.
That Marine won't be there today when Mike Rose accepts the Medal of Honor at the White House, but several of the other men he kept alive in the jungles of Laos 47 years ago will be. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.